Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: أحسنوا في عقب غيركم تحفظوا في عقبكم.
Imam Ali stated, "Do good with the bereaved ones of others, so that good is done to your bereaved ones as well." Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. Dear friends, one of the interesting and profound lessons which we learn from the truly universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is to think about the future and to be very careful about the future. Now, of course, we find in the historical texts and the books of traditions that Imam Ali alayhi salam pondered and thought about the instability and the tumultuous future, and this made him cry ceaselessly. Now here, when thinking about the tumultuous future, it doesn't mean worldly and livelihood means. It doesn't mean that Imam Ali alayhi salam was worried about where his rizq, his sustenance, was going to come from. He wasn't worried about, you know, what would happen to his job in the future. No. Here, when we're talking about the future and the tumultuousness, the instability of the future, here we are talking about, and Imam Ali is telling us, the future of remaining upon the true path. It is the future of protecting ourselves from sins. It is the future of potential disobedience to Almighty Allah. Now, of course, you know, we don't think about these things in general, to be honest. When we think about the future, we think about, you know, the bills we have to pay, the investments we need to make, how much money we're going to leave our children, what is going to happen to our jobs, what's going to happen to our house payments, our car payments, our bills, what are we going to do with life. I mean, there's millions and millions of things that we think about when it comes to the future, and we might even cry about them. But no, Imam Ali tells us that these things, first of all, are not so valuable that we should cry over them and weep over them and worry about them. Surely Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Allah the Mighty, the Exalted, will take care of our sustenance if we work hard and we try hard. But here, What we're thinking about is a future of our religion. Will we remain on this path? Will we remain steadfast upon Islam? Despite the trials and the hardships, will we waver or will we be determined to continue the path of Allah? And what of our sins, the sins which we have committed in our lives? Unfortunately, whether they were knowingly or unknowingly, voluntarily or involuntarily, how will we answer Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, when He asks us about these sins? And so when we realize that there is such a heavy burden upon our shoulders, surely one begins to cry. But after this crying, after this regret, we must always remember to ask for forgiveness. And surely, if we try our best, Allah, the most oft and the most quick to forgive, will surely forgive us. Beautiful lessons brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib this means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتبيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridvi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in chapter 3 of the Quran in verse number 33 makes an announcement where he says inna Allah astafa, verily God has chosen Adam and then Nuh, and then the family of Abraham, and then Imran, alal alameen, over the rest of the people in the world. When you look at this verse of the Quran, you come to realize that all human beings have been created by Almighty God, but they are not equal in the eyes of God. as far as their status is concerned, you know, when it comes to the prophets of God, the messengers of God, those who represent Him in conveying His message, they are at a higher, you know, status than other human beings. I would like to take this opportunity to actually talk about the special status that God has given to Ahlul Bayt, the family of the Prophet. There is a very famous scholar of Quran by the name of Al-Jassas. He's a Sunni scholar, and his book is known as Ahkam al-Quran. He deals with the verses of the Quran on the religious laws. And when it comes to this verse in chapter 4, verse number 43, about this prohibition of people from, you know, going into the mosque in the state of impurity, then he talks about this exception to the rule. And he says that this is a unique honor accorded to Ali by the Prophet. And he talks about it, and he says, you know, nobody was allowed to go into the mosque of the Prophet in that state. Illa Ali bin Abi Talib. And then he talks about it, and he says, you know, one of the narrators says that, well, there was no choice for Ali because his house was such that the door opened inside. And so Al-Jassas makes a comment. He says, this fellow didn't know that there are many other houses whose doors were opening inside, and they were told to close their doors. And so this is not just an, you know, coincidence, or, you know, it was there from before, therefore he was allowed to go through the mosque. No. He says, this is actually al-khususiyya. This is an honor exclusively for Ali. Min dun ghayri. No one else was part of this from the companions of the Prophet. And then he gives an example. He says, just as if you look at the Muslim martyrs in the Battle of Uhud in Tabuk. He says, there were many Muslims who lost their lives, and they are highly honored and respected by Almighty God for sacrificing their life for the cause of Islam. But when it came to Ja'far, the brother of Ali, you know, who was also killed in that battle, God actually gave him two wings that he can fly with the angels in the paradise. So he says, just as that distinction was given to Ja'far after his martyrdom, this is a distinction unique given to Ali during his own lifetime.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Guantanamo Bay, where U.S. officials claim to be used as a detention facilities for hundreds of the most wanted terrorists on the earth, mainly Al-Qaeda and Taliban members. But there were dozens of prisoners who were not terrorists, but freedom seekers who were following their goals via peaceful attempts. The late Dr. Sayyid Muhammad Ali Shah Mousawi Gardizi, or the prisoner number 1154, was one of them. He was brutally tortured by the U.S. forces during his nearly 4 years of detention in U.S.-run Guantanamo Bay. The late Gardizi was known as a popular political, cultural and social figure in Afghanistan. He, along with 35 others, lost their lives 3 years ago after two Daesh terrorists detonated their explosive belts among them during Juma prayers in a mosque in Gardez, the capital city of southeastern Paktia province. Now, along with the arrival of the third martyrdom anniversary of the late Gardezi and 35 of his relatives, this webinar is launched to pay respect to him as a great man, as well as to review the American model of human rights and democracy. In the eyes of the attendees of this webinar, the U.S. just follows its own geopolitical goals under different slogans. And when it comes to dealing with anti-arrogance figures like the late Gardezi, and then this is American gun that operates instead of law, regulation and humanitarian values.
On regard as the United States claims it's defending human rights, but persons like Dr. Sayed Muhammad Ali Shah had neither held weapons nor committed any attempt against our national interests. He just sought to provide services to his own people and carry out intellectual and cultural activities.
The Americans did not come to Afghanistan to build a nation. Their main goal was to keep a close eye on the regional countries, mainly the U.S. rivals, including China, Russia, and Iran. Slogans such as human rights and democracy serve only as a tool at the hand of the U.S. to pursue its geopolitical goals.
It seems that the late Gardezi had already realized that the American model of human rights and democracy have no place in Afghanistan. That is why he seriously resumed his cultural and social activities in his hometown, Gardez, after he was released from Guantanamo Bay.
The moves that the U.S. and NATO pursued under the guise of human rights and women's rights were often at odds with the country's indigenous culture. Later, all Afghans, mainly well-known figures like the late Gardezi, realized that the U.S. has been working for its own interests.
In the meantime, the attendees of this webinar insist on following the path of great figures like the late Gardezi as the symbols of his strength, resistance, and freedom-seeker leaders. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
As U.S. sanctions are still haunting Iran's oil sector, Tehran is resorting to domestic firms to keep the strategic sector up and running. This event is one of those efforts. Iran's Petroleum Industries Innotech Park hosted state and private oil companies as well as science-based firms to highlight the major needs of Iran's oil and petrochemical industries and find domestic suppliers to meet their demands.
In recent years, the restrictions and sanctions that have been imposed on our country have forced us to rely on our domestic resources. I dare say that Iran is capable of supplying at least 70% of its oil and gas industries, but it takes an all-out effort to let this happen, and that's what we do at the Petroleum Industry Innotech Park. We link our oil companies to potential suppliers and handpick and invest in the best viable products.
One of the primary concerns of an oil project is to ensure a sustainable water supply system. U.S. oil embargoes against Iran also target the subcategories of this branch, such as filtration membranes that are used in chillers and cooling systems. Experts say, as a result of the sanctions, it takes a painstakingly lengthy and complicated process to supply such products.
We are now in urgent need of what we call reserve osmosis system. It's a type of an industrial-scale water treatment system that removes contaminants from water by using pressure to force water molecules through a semi-permeable membrane. We cannot easily import these systems.
The good news is there are many domestic companies here that can supply ultrafiltration systems, like this firm that claims to have built competitive filters that outpace their foreign counterparts, both in quality and cost-effectiveness.
We are proud to announce that we have developed an ultrafiltration system that is equipped with ejectors and thermocompressors, which are a cutting-edge technology and are rarely used in other international brands. This is why our price is one-third of that of foreign counterparts. With our systems, we no longer need to go through the complicated process of importing such equipment.
In 2018, Iran was the third largest oil producer in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, following the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the nuclear deal and the reimposition of sanctions in the same year. Iran's oil output almost halved to less than 2 million barrels a day, while its exports tumbled to less than 1 million BPDs, down from 2.5 million. This has prompted the country to rebuild its oil sector using its domestic know-how, a long-term goal, which if accomplished, will make the country an oil power.
Less than a century ago, Iran marked a milestone by nationalizing its petroleum industry. And today, it is on track toward indigenizing the strategic sector. Experts say this would be another turning point in the country's oil industry, since it would shield the country's crude from the impacts of U.S. sanctions. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
New advances have been made by Yemen's armed forces backed by local tribes toward the oil-rich province of Marib to liberate it from the Saudi-backed forces. The recent advances were made in conjunction with a major victory of the Yemeni army against the Saudi-backed militant groups in Al-Baida province.
Marib is the center of the mobilization of the enemy forces, and therefore the Saudi-led coalition tried to distract the Yemeni army by opening other fronts, as happened in Al-Baida. But the Yemeni army is fully aware of all the evasions of the enemies. Marib is now surrounded from all sides, and we control all the mountainous heights and strategic points overlooking Marib. There's a small area in Beihan if the Yemeni army takes control of. Supplies will be completely cut off to the enemy.
Military experts said the Yemeni army attacked the Saudi-backed forces in the Baqatha area and Rahaba Directorate of southern Marib, as well as Al-Bilq al-Qibli Mountains overlooking the western neighborhoods of the city of Marib. The Yemeni army, the experts said, is now surrounding the city from all sides.
Our forces managed to control the most important mountains and hills in Marib, and the consecutive victories in Al-Baida gave our forces an advantage in encircling Marib and besieging it from all sides. We have been able to liberate most of the southern and western regions. The battle is settled in favor of the Yemeni army, and the enemy is in a dire state.
For many months now, the Yemeni army has intensified its operations to take control of strategic Marib province. Observers say Yemen's army has made remarkable advances against the Saudi-backed forces, meaning that Saudi Arabia is up to lose its last stronghold in northern Yemen.
Yemenis say their army will eventually liberate Marib from the Saudi-backed forces and flip the table over Saudi Arabia and its allies. They believe that this is the only way to push Riyadh to stop its years-long war and siege and accept the political solution. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The Palestinian Health Ministry in the Gaza Strip held a press conference to attract global attention on the sufferings of the cancer patients in the enclave due to the Israeli siege. The closure of borders has increased pressure on the patients, ending either with their death due to the lack of treatment services in Gaza hospitals or unjustified restrictions imposed on movement for patients who need treatment across borders.
Due to the closure of borders, I can't travel abroad for treatment. The treatment here is limited and sometimes not available at all. Human rights groups should put pressure on Israel to let us travel abroad for treatment.
While almost 2,000 new cases are being diagnosed with cancer each year, 60% of them need to travel abroad for treatment, which is denied by Israel. The ministry has recorded more than 3,000 deaths among cancer patients over the past 5 years.
When I was first diagnosed with pancreas cancer, my permission to leave Gaza was issued immediately. But Israel delayed my travel for more than 2 months, and that led to the spreading of the cancer in my body.
The health ministry in Gaza calls on the international community to pressure Israeli occupation to lift these restrictions on patients and facilitate their access to specialized hospitals outside Gaza to enhance opportunities for their urgent treatment.
Unfortunately, 60% of our patients which we use to do the referral for them, they usually do not get a permission from the Israeli side to leave the Gaza to receive their treatment. Sometimes this permission usually delayed for 2 to 3 months. When the case become very, very complicated, United Nations and all the people who are looking for peace in the area to interfere very strongly in this issue, to force the Israeli side to not to put all these pressures on the cancer patients and to issue their permission very urgently, freely, because this is a humanitarian issue. This is not a political issue.
The usual Israeli restrictions and movement, along with preventing the entry of medicines, have doubled the suffering of cancer patients in Gaza and practically denied access to medical treatment, posing a threat to their lives. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
After gaining control over more than 200 districts in Afghanistan, the Taliban now seem to have a bigger plan that is capturing provincial centers across some strategic areas of the country.
The militants recently launched heavy attacks on centers of Herat, Kandahar and Helmand provinces in western and southern Afghanistan. But Afghan forces, mainly the commander troops and Afghan Air Force, plus local armed fronts, pushed back the Taliban from the entrance gates of these strategic cities.
Mohammed Ismail Khan, locally known as Amir Saib, is 78 years old. He is a popular political and jihadi leader in Afghanistan. He and thousands of his followers have decided to pick up guns and defend their home city, Herat in western Afghanistan, which was on the verge of collapse by Taliban. Ismail Khan believes that one of the main reasons behind the sharp advances of Taliban is the legitimacy granted to them by Washington under the U.S. Taliban Doha deal.
The U.S. began talks with the Taliban and granted them political legitimacy. That's why many countries are supporting the Taliban, but will not sit idle and will continue our fight against them.
The Taliban have so far failed to gain control over provincial centers in southern and western Afghanistan. But the rise of war has prompted thousands of local villagers like Golgotai to flee their houses in search of shelter.
I have lost my husband and two of my sons in Taliban's attacks on our district. We are deprived of any humanitarian aid by the government. We are tired of war. Please stop fighting for the sake of God.
In such circumstances, the Afghan government simultaneously insists on continuation of peace talks with the Taliban negotiating team in Doha and strengthening war fronts against the Taliban to retake the lost areas that cover nearly half of districts in Afghanistan. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Tunisia's political crisis and rising tensions in the country have sparked reactions from countries across the globe. Tunisian President Kais Saied held a phone call with his Algerian counterpart Abdelmajid Tabboun and discussed the latest developments. Saied assured him that Tunisia is on the right path to establish democracy and that there will be important decisions soon. The Egyptian government has also said it is following with great interest what's happening in Tunisia and what authorities are doing there to achieve security and stability. Last week, the Tunisian president invoked emergency powers to seize control of the government, remove the prime minister, and freeze parliament.
The president used the provisions of the constitution and he respected the law. But some people in Tunisia say this was a coup. The president should respect the human rights and follow the constitution.
President Kais Saied has held meetings at the presidential palace with ministers of foreign affairs of Libya, Morocco, Algeria, and Saudi Arabia. They were briefed on the latest developments in Tunisia and affirmed their support for the Tunisian people and for the recent decisions of the president. Tunisian President Kais Saied also affirmed his commitment to bearing the trust and responsibility of protecting the country and confronting all attempts to strike and fragment it. The European Union has called for the resumption of Tunisian parliamentary activity as soon as possible. It also urged the political parties in Tunisia to respect the constitution and avoid violence.
Tunisian people are waiting for Saied to name a new prime minister to line out a roadmap after he invoked emergency powers. This will determine the next step and what lies ahead for the country's future. Amir Bouka, Tunis.
We are all against the health pass. That was the main slogan that brought together many protesters all over France. For the third week in a row, they continued marching against the government's decision to put in place a health pass for all citizens. This is an electronic document that every citizen has to show in public places that proves that they are vaccinated or have a negative PCR test. Medical figures are crystal clear. In European countries where the majority of its population is vaccinated, like the UK, the Netherlands, Denmark or Ireland, the COVID virus and its Delta variant are under control. So why are these protesters taking the street again?
I am in favor of the vaccination. Not for this one, because we have not enough information about this vaccine. So I am in favor of the vaccination, but I am against the health path. We have our liberties and no one should tell us what we should do or not.
In hospitals, doctors say that the new wave of people with severe COVID symptoms are all non-vaccinated persons. In Martinique and La Réunion, two overseas French territories, a new lockdown has begun, given that very few people are vaccinated. The vaccination campaign has accelerated the last 3 weeks. In France now, more than 50% have received two jabs of the vaccine. So is it responsible to protest against these mandatory measures?
Only science will tell us, and science needs time to be proven efficient. So we need more time to see what's really happening.
I am not against the vaccine itself. I am more against the health pass and the political use of it. If the government had given sufficient means to health workers and hospitals to handle the COVID crisis, it would have been more efficient.
3,000 police officers have been mobilized to control all the marches today in the French capital. There were some clashes. It's amazing to see so many protesters on the street at the start of the holiday season. Some say that with these protests against the authoritarian measures of the French government, the Yellow Vest movement rose from its ashes. Despite clear indications that vaccination is effective in reducing symptomatic cases and deaths from COVID-19, protests continue in France, but rather against a mandatory health pass considered as a violation of individual liberties rather than against the vaccination itself. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
A new victory against the Saudi-backed militant groups was made by Yemen's armed forces in the second phase of the Al-Nasr al-Mubin operation. The spokesman of the Yemeni army, Yahya Sariya, said Nu'man and Nata regions of the country's central province of Al-Bayda were fully liberated from the control of the Saudi-backed terrorists. He said the military operation had left hundreds of Saudi-backed militants killed and injured, adding that the Yemeni forces had also captured a number of the militants.
Our armed forces have completed the second phase of the Al-Nasr al-Mubin operation, which led to the liberation of the districts of Nateh and Nu'man, and the defeat of the elements of the militant groups associated with the Saudi-led coalition and inflicting heavy losses on them, while hundreds of them were killed, wounded, and captured.
Sariya also said the Yemeni forces have confiscated militants' weapons, which are US-made, according to military experts. They say this is yet another proof of the US military support for Daesh and Al-Qaeda terrorists in Yemen.
This operation proved that the United States supports terrorist groups, whether militarily or through statements accusing the Yemeni army of hampering the peaceful solutions. America is the one who directs and controls the terrorist groups. Today, there is a lot of evidence proving Washington's support for terrorist groups, including American-made weapons that the Yemeni army seized during the recent operation.
2 weeks ago, the Yemeni army took control of large areas in Al-Bayda, the first stage of the Al-Nasr al-Mubin operation that was launched on July 13th. The operation was part of military efforts to push members of Al-Qaeda and Daesh out of their strongholds in Al-Bayda.
Observers say the U.S. support for the terrorist groups in Al-Bayda is aimed at hampering the Yemeni army's advances toward Marib, the last stronghold of Saudi-backed militants in northern Yemen. However, the Yemeni army says it will continue the operations until the liberation of all Yemeni territories and putting an end to years-long Saudi-imposed war. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
There is no evidence of institutional racism in the UK, says a report commissioned by the British government, but a landmark art exhibition on the doorsteps of Queen Elizabeth II paints a very different picture.
War in the Babylon is the title of this exhibition about black communities and their long struggle against systemic racism here in the UK. It comes 10 years after the police killing of unarmed black man, Mark Duggan, on the streets of London, with the aim of shining a light on his family's struggle for justice, as well as many more families who have lost a loved one at the hands of the British state.
Since 1990, there have been 1,433 people who have died in police custody. While the majority of deaths are white British, there is a disproportionate overrepresentation of black people who die as a result of use of force or restraint by the police.
10 years since the killing of Mark Duggan, but in 2015, in Haringey, the same borough, they killed Jermaine Baker. Last week, we had a notice put out that another person of colour, black person, has been killed in Haringey by the same police.
Stafford Scott, the curator of the exhibition, and who supported many of these families in their fight for justice, designed the showcase to illustrate how systemic racism is not just present in the police force, but something that permeates through different institutions in British society.
The War in a Babylon is an exhibition that we hope encapsulates the entirety of the black experience in the UK. You'd have recently heard this foolishness from some report by some geezer called Tony Sewell that said that there's no such thing as institutional racism in this country. War in a Babylon says that that's an absolute lie and provides the absolute evidence that that is a lie.
The pictures, videos and texts present an account for those whose voices are often not heard, or worse still, willfully ignored by the mainstream.
We're at the Mall. That's the same address as the Queen of England, the Queen of England resides. We've moved the front line in the fight against racism and the fight for truth and rights from off of the estates, from out of the hood, and we've taken it right to the heart of the establishment.
The need for exhibitions like this is as pertinent now as it's ever been, especially as the British government expands policies like racially disproportionate blanket stop and search, while simultaneously denying the existence of institutional racism, signalling to black communities in the UK that their historic fight for equality is far from over. Ahmed Cabello, London.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
the limelight.
More than a billion sea creatures across the Pacific Northwest perished in this year's heat wave, and it's just a taste of what's to come. We now present you an article written by Gabrielle Cannon. The piece is titled, Baked Barnacles, Scorched Cherries, The Disastrous Impact of Heat Waves on Plants and Animals. The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. Forecasts foreshadowed the Pacific Northwest devastating heat wave at the end of June. Marine biologist Christopher Harley was alarmed and intrigued. Then came the smell, and his feelings somberly shifted. Christopher Harley said, "It was this putrid smell of decay. Across hundreds of miles of coastline, the extreme heat baked the barnacles, seaweed, and small sea creatures exposed to the elements along the shore. Starfish that failed to crawl to shadier spots were cooked alive. Mussels lay agape along the rocks, the tissue crisped between their shells." Armed with special equipment, Christopher Harley and his team of researchers at the University of British Columbia in Western Canada descended to the beaches to measure the body temperature of the mussels, but it was too late. By the third day of the record-breaking heat wave, they all had died. He said, "We were just walking across carpets of dead mussels on the shore in awe." Initial estimates show that over a billion creatures that live in the shallow waters across the Pacific Northwest perished in the heat that week. Scientists expect the impact will have a trickle-down effect on the ecosystem and the other animals that rely on those that died for food and habitat. Christopher Harley, a marine biologist, added, "I knew the heat would be ecologically impactful, but I wasn't ready for the magnitude of the destruction." He added, "The more places I visited and the more death I saw, the more sobering the whole event became." The unprecedented heat events that scorched the West this summer, smashing dozens of local temperature records across the region, had disastrous effects on people, plants, and animals. Climate scientists say this is just a taste of what's to come. As the environment continues to warm due to human-caused global heating, spiking temperatures will become more frequent, more intense, and last longer. Because heat and drought are inextricably linked, the compounding catastrophes that have plagued the Western United States and Canada this summer will persist into the future, continuing to wreak havoc on ecosystems, infrastructure, and agriculture. Scientists are still working to document and understand the impact of the recent heat waves, but the research has been clear that this anomalous event could become the norm over the next 30 years as the planet continues to warm. Andrew Hull, a meteorologist for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, Physical Sciences Laboratory, said it's going to continue to get hotter, noting that rising temperatures are unequivocally linked to human activities. He explained, "That means it is going to take much moisture supply in terms of precipitation to stave off drought. That is going to be a game changer in terms of how we live." According to a study led by researchers at the University of Colorado, published earlier this year, extreme heat could increase crop damage tenfold. The real-time effects are already being seen across the West, where farmers and ranchers have struggled to adapt to extremely dry conditions, even before temperatures began to spike. According to the British Columbia Fruit Growers Association, More than half of the cherry crop in Western Canada was damaged in late June. Pinda Dhaliwal, the association's president, told CBC News, "It seems like somebody took a blowtorch to it and just singed it." He added, "Even cherries that looked untouched from the outside were cooked, appearing hot all the way through to the pit." Growers and their respective associations have also reported that raspberries, blueberries and blackberries were baked across the northern west coast before they could be picked, and stone fruits and apples were damaged and burnt from the high temperatures. Experts from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, have expressed concern that shriveled wheat berries and diminished kernels will mean a drastic reduction in wheat production this season. Temperatures above 95 degrees Fahrenheit, 35 degrees Celsius, have also been found to change parts of potatoes from starch to sugar and stunt their growth. Meanwhile, a drought-induced shortage of California's thirsty tomatoes, used for processing, is expected to spike prices for the foods made from them, like pizza sauce and ketchup. As of last month, close to half of the contiguous United States was mired in drought, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association scientists, and more than 15% of the nation experienced record heat for June, the largest number of spiking temperatures ever recorded. Extreme heat and drought, which are individually costly and devastating disasters, go hand in hand, complicating efforts to adapt and recover. The combined conditions also set the stage for fast-burning wildfires that have already torched close to 3 million acres, that is 1.2 million hectares of land, this year. Steve Ostoja, director of the U.S. Department of Agriculture California Climate Hub, said, "You have the gradual shift of climate change working in the background," he added, "but the extreme events are the things that really throw you off." According to Steve Ostoja, the historical record indicates between 4 and 6 extreme heat waves a year. But climate models indicate that on current trajectories, there could be between 25 and 30 of these events by mid-century. He said, "That's a huge difference," adding, "That basically means it is going to be that hot all the time." Water and moisture that could help alleviate strain during the extreme heat is currently in short supply because of the drought. Plants experience higher stress, animals can't keep cool, and shallow waterways warm faster, making habitats inhospitable. Steve Ostoja said, "It is looking like water scarcity is going to be the theme of the future, and we know warming is in our future," noting that there will be a marked shift in how agriculture is approached in places such as California, which currently produces over a third of the country's vegetables and two-thirds of the country's fruits and nuts. Jonathan Stillman, a professor of biology at San Francisco State University, said animals are also struggling to adapt, and for some, the prognosis is grim. His research shows that for animals that have already adjusted to higher heat, it will be even harder to adapt when the temperatures spike further. He said they don't have the ability to cope when the temperature goes just a little bit above the maximum that they're adapted to. He added, "They can't tolerate just a little bit more." This includes small birds living on the edge of their water needs, desert dwellers who have nowhere else to go when the nights fail to cool down, and fish that aren't able to reach the areas they spawn. spring-run Chinook salmon in California's Central Valley were decimated by the heat after making a significant recovery following the 2018 campfire that critically diminished the already threatened fish. More than 83% of the roughly 15,000 adults in Butte Creek, the largest population of the federally protected fish near Chico, California, died, according to Howard Brown, a senior policy advisor with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Fisheries West Coast region. Calling this an indicator of the severity of the drought and heat wave, he said, "It is devastating. It is the largest loss of adult salmon we have ever seen in the Central Valley of California." Salmon in the Columbia River, further north, were also documented swimming slowly and lethargically through the overheated waters with large red abrasions and burn marks. According to research from Bradfield Lyon, a professor at the Climate Change Institute at the University of Maine, as heat waves become more frequent and more intense, they're also expected to impact physically larger areas at once. Bradfield Lyon said, "By mid-century, the special size of heat waves in the United States are expected to increase between about 50% and 80% from what they are in the current climate." He added, "The frequency will increase, the duration will increase, as well as the intensity. It's alarming." But Bradfield Lyon and each of other researchers hope this episode and the promise of more extreme heat serve as a call for change. The models used to predict the disasters to come are based on current levels of energy consumption and carbon dioxide emission. There are advances being made and the potential for progress abounds. Likening the situation to fire drills used to teach school children about how to respond during emergencies, Bradfield Lyon, a professor of climate change at the University of Maine, said, "The way I look at it is that it is a very stark warning." He said, "The teacher would say, now don't panic, but head as quickly as possible for the exits," adding, "In this case, the exit is burning of fossil fuels. We don't need to panic, but we certainly need to head as quickly as possible in that direction."
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by famous Iranian Shiite orator and lecturer Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
تمام شؤون امامت الان برپاس برقرار شما همتون میدونید شبای قدر
مقدس. The position of imamate is active in all its dimensions now. But how and through whom? The answer is Imam al-Mahdi. You might have heard that on the night of Qadr or the night of power during the month of Ramadan, the destiny and fate of many believing people for the next upcoming year is ordained. This means that what's going to happen to the believing people for the upcoming year is given by Allah to the angels and by them to the Imam of the age, who is Imam al-Mahdi. This means that Imam al-Mahdi is still active and he is doing well, his missions ordered to him by Allah. One of his greatest missions is conveying the graces of Allah to the believing people during the night of Qadr, and these graces could be health or wealth. As we have in the narrations, no angel of Allah will come down unless he goes to the door of Imam al-Mahdi ajalallah. Now, one of the attributes of the infallibles, including Imam al-Mahdi, is that they are like a crossroad for the angels to pass by. Therefore, Imam al-Mahdi is doing his duties well and is well supported by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.